Okay, we've gotten. We've gotten toward I think, the back of the Book of Mormon study. Somebody tell me what page we're on in your class for.
61.
Page 61. There's a table we had covered under B, style and content.
Page
61. Paperwork rearranged here. Okay. And gotten down, there's a table of King James Version compared to the Book of Mormon. We went through and talked about that a bit. There's a lot more that could be said about that, but you know, probably doesn't benefit the class particularly to go through the other examples. These are just, that's what these are. They're examples. There's more data available, and you can find it without too much trouble. Available a lot of places. We've gotten down to number two, the Bible. And what I want to try to do, we've talked a bit about the Book of Mormon, where it came from, how it came into being, some of the issues around it, a lot of the issues around Joseph Smith and the events that occurred in that we're going to see a little more of this. The disagreements, the conflicts that exist within the Book of Mormon compared to other sources. Joseph Smith's going to be one. The Book of Mormon itself doesn't always agree in what it teaches. And so there are problems internally to the document as well. So the intent here is let's talk a little bit about the Bible, since that's what we've been comparing it with all along. And, you know, what's the circumstances of the situation with the generation of the Old Testament and the New Testament? So that's where I want to focus this morning, or start this morning. When you look at the Bible, of course, the Bible contains how many books? 66. How many authors?
40.
Roughly. 40 authors. In a period of time, and we talked about the 2200 to 6400 A.D. that the Book of Mormon is written, so it's 2600 years total. How does that compare to the Bible, written over a period of what time?
About 1,500 years.
About 1,600 years. And if you had to put down in your own words what the theme of the Bible is, what's its message, what would it be?
God's plan to redeem man.
Everybody has read the Bible, I trust. At least some part of it, I think. Who else? Have one answer.
Salvation.
Yeah.
Okay.
To Christ.
Okay. So y'all kind of come to the same answer. And this, you know, the Bible is interesting. There's a lot of data about, in terms strictly the Old Testament, in terms of some of the history. Sort of goes back all the way back to Genesis as far as the creation as well. So there's information for our benefit, but in truth, what the Bible, the Old Testament was directed toward was Christ. What the Gospels were directed toward was Christ while he was here, and what the Acts and the Epistles are directed toward is as a result of Christ being here. And they're oriented, their theme is pretty clear throughout. Okay?
Wally?
Yeah.
You're talking about the time period. Contrast that to the Mormons. So, you know, here you have the Exodus. It's kind of written, Moses, when the Exodus was happening, 1500 B.C. And according to what you were saying about the Book of Mormon, that first expedition was 2000 B.C., but written until 471 A.D., or whatever that date was. So it's 2,500 years removed from the time of the writings. That's nothing unique by the Bible. Is a lot of the things are written in close proximity to.
Good point. Good point. And you had. Well, we'll talk about this a little bit in a second. Rocky makes a good point in terms of those who were writing in the who are actually doing the writing in the Bible were eyewitnesses. Now, there are some who would claim that, Mormons would claim that some of the people that were writing down the, let me rephrase that. The people who supposedly were writing down some of these events in the Book of Mormon, like Nephi, and Ether's another one, were historians of their day. But how did that all that get recorded? Who recorded who? I know Joseph Smith found the plates, quote unquote, but where those plates? How did those plates get recorded? Mormon's son, Moroni. Mormon took care of securing him. Moroni took care of providing it. But it was, as Rocky's pointing out, it was way removed from the actual events. So, it's another difference between the two. When you talk about documentary evidence, and y'all have heard this before, and I tell you, it just cannot be overemphasized. We have in the Bible a wealth of documentary information that the sum of which can give me and you confidence that the book that we have in front of us is an accurate representation of what was actually recorded originally. And that's a study all into itself. Y'all have heard bits and pieces of that over time. It's a good study in and of itself. If you want to help build your faith in the document, the book itself, and is it a valid historical document? And it just exceeds what any other ancient book provides. What do you have in the case of Book of Mormon?
Inconsistency.
That, you're getting ahead of me in terms of their documentation.
Almost zero.
And the original is buried somewhere, according to Mormon doctrine. They buried it back in the ground. There was one man who did the interpretation, right? On one document that, if you think about it for just a minute, I haven't spent much time on this. We had six plates that have, if written on both sides, have 12 pages. If any of you have seen a Book of Mormon, you're going to see a lot of information in the Book of Mormon. And I know hieroglyphics are written in a way to convey a bigger message than simply the way we would put sentences together, the character to provide. Think of it as providing a sentence, or maybe even a paragraph. Can you imagine 12 pages turning into the Book of Mormon? I mean, in and of itself is crazy in terms of this is the interpretation of, or the translation rather, of these six plates. So that, it's another thing that just kind of stands out to me when you talk about comparison with this, with the rationality, actually. The numbers I put down on here are probably even greater. They're even greater than what I've shown, because other documents have been found since, particularly in the area of quotations. I think the quotations, if I remember right, are something like 25,000 now for the Gospels. So it's a well-documented book. There are some other unique aspects of the Bible. And, these do not make or break the story. Is the Bible real? The question is the Bible real? Or is the Book of Mormon real? But there is a message that comes through with this. You look at people who have been involved in writing the Bible. Moses, David, Amos. I mean, just go down your list of books in the Bible and think about who wrote those, who was the author of those, or who was involved in that authorship, and the roles they played. I mean, you had military generals, you had kings, you had shepherds, you had political leaders, you had a tax collector, You had a student of the law of Moses, that is, and Paul. So you have all this myriad of men that came from all walks of life. They were in different periods of time. They were in different places. And they were writing in different languages, Hebrew, Greek, Aramaic. And so you take all that, and yet when you come to the end of it, think about this on human terms. You got all these authors living all these times, writing about this subject, these subjects. And what do we say? What did y'all answer early on about the theme of the Bible? It all comes toward the same end. And I realize there are skeptics who will say, oh, there are conflicts in the Bible. If you start taking a look at the conflicts in the Bible, that is, in what's said in one place versus another, you'll eliminate them. You can eliminate them. And they don't find that many to begin with. And there are, you know, a couple different books I know about that deal with what are supposed contradictions in the Bible. You don't find conflict. You don't find contradictions. It's nothing like what we've already seen in the Book of Mormon. Okay? It's amazing. The Bible is an amazing book, but I don't have to tell this crew that. The Book of Mormon is an amazing book, too, for a different reason. Yes, sir?
You know, it's as human beings, even when we kind of validate things in history, we get several historians giving different accounts to point to the same idea, which is typical of the theme of the Bible. And it's almost as if, you know, well, one, we know, like Paul writes in Ephesians, that we're fighting a spiritual warfare, where there's like demons and principalities that are beyond our control. So it almost makes you wonder how much influence the devil has in keeping a religion where one man out of 12 plates, he writes one account, and then there are almost a billion people that follow that, and they don't question it. And the Bible itself tells us to question things and go back and check the accounts. And historian after historian validates everything the Bible says. Whereas the Book of Mormon is written by one man, out of his own ideas, with an apple that hit him on his head. And then, you know, and then we get all these people that they do not even question anything. All right, it's just...
If we have time, I'll share a little experience with you that validates the very point you're talking about. By the way, you may have just hit the nail on the head, and apple falling out of the tree. You know, we wonder some of the times how these things came about. Maybe that was the influence. Let me reinforce one more time, and I'll do this if I get to what I want to do. Remember the people. These people are sincere. People who show up at your door are sincere. They believe what they believe, and they're not bad people, but they have been. They're involved in a religion. They're involved in a system that just keeps propagating more and more of the same kind of people that believe the same thing. And remember when we talked about cults, that's how that works. And it's gotten so far, you know, 180 years of this, and it's not at all obvious to the world around us, to the world in general, that this is a cult. It has all the characteristics of that. And it's not like our fellow, it's not obvious like our fellow David Koresh.
Koresh.
David Koresh was a member here one time. David Koresh. David Koresh. And you know, he was claiming, I think he was claiming to be Christ, wasn't he? And so that, you know, people say that's ridiculous. Well, in a way, when Joseph Smith was around initially, people around him had the same reaction. It's just that one survived. And that's what you have today. Okay, let's keep on going. Book of Mormon, we've talked about the writer, of course, being a money digger, the fellow who found this, Joseph Smith. A lot of this is rehashed, so I'm not going to spend any time on it. There have been volumes written on Joseph Smith and his character. The fact that he was a money digger, a polygamist, an adulterer, all these things. And of course, he was in jail on occasion. as well, so in trouble with the law. But you can find just a number of books on Joseph Smith that have been written over the years. Now, what the Mormons have done, to a large extent, they don't spend any time talking about... Well, they've rewritten history. Let me put it that way. They've rewritten history, in fact, in terms of what they teach today about Joseph Smith. But if you go back and look at Joseph Smith's original writings in the testimony of those around him at the time he lived, you get a whole different picture, and we've talked about some of that. I'd mentioned to you about the three witnesses and the eight witnesses, and the comment that we covered a little bit, the comment that was made about the, or wants to be made about the Mormons, by the Mormons, that the 11 witnesses never denied the Book of Mormon and the things associated, the events that went on before. And so that's why you see these subject matter of the three witnesses and the eight witnesses. That's just, you know, it's just not true what Mormons would try to teach today to their people. In fact, the three witnesses that were in that, well, they're in the Book of Mormon in the title, in the first few pages. In fact, they did. And I gave you some of the, I think I gave you most of the history on that, some of their comments that they made. These three witnesses left the church, and a couple of them made comments, public comments, that makes it pretty clear that they disavowed what they've been involved in. And that tells you a couple of things. One, it starts to bring to forefront the veracity of these men, the honesty of these men in any of their dealings in the past. But at least at this stage in time, they've repented of some of those and admitted wrong. And it certainly brings into light the veracity or lack thereof of the whole issue around the plates and the interpretation of the plates, translation of the plates, etc. Martin Harris, we talked about Martin Harris because he was the he was the guy that went and talked to the Professor Anton about the reformed Egyptian hieroglyphics business. Well, he also, when he took the manuscript, as I recall, setting up the testimony. When I was finished setting up the testimony, when he went into the printer's office, the printer actually asked him about the plates, and this is what he told the plate to the guy that, I saw them with a spiritual eye. You know, that's an eyewitness account. You know, it tells you a physical thing, just not, you know, that, at least he admitted at the time that he had not seen the plates literally. He actually joined the Shakers. And the Shakers, their belief is in a male, the God is a male and female, that Jesus represented the male side, and Ann Lee, who was founder of the Shakers, represented the female side, just for your enjoyment. We're not going to study the Shakers. But he did make the comment that he had as much evidence for the Shaker book as he had for the Book of Mormon. And in other words, I have none. It's the way you and I would state that. And then you see the of the 11 witnesses that show up, only Smith's family members didn't disavow the book and the whole series of events. And this was in June of 1838, by the way. And the only ones therefore that remained were his family members. This is 8 years removed from the printing of the book. So, give you a sense of history. Mormons have long, if you get to this point, this is one of their selling points, that the Book of Mormon is validated by archaeology. If you see some statements, and there's some counter statements from the Smithsonian in 1A, and you see the counter in 1A, subparagraph 1, where they contradicted what was claimed in this pamphlet of the Mormons. No evidence whatever of any migration from Israel to America, and likewise no evidence of pre-Columbian, that is pre-Columbus or really before Western influence, had any knowledge of Christianity, the Bible. So they just say, you know, based on archaeological records, that's just wrong. B, it may seem kind of strange to you. B was a letter written by a prominent Mormon. And I guess he, from reading the letter, he was somehow involved with the Smithsonian. And he wrote this letter making this statement, these statements about how the Book of Mormon was a trusted book relative to archaeology and finding things that come about by archaeology. The letter you see in the down at the bottom of it, written to Ernest English on May 3rd, 36. It would be distributed in 59, widely distributed at a meeting, and then it went out from there. There is a letter that was written between 36 and 59, and it was written and had and was in the hands of the people who ultimately distributed this letter in 59. So they made this guy that wrote something in 36, made a claim, the Smithsonian in 51, and you can read what it says in 51, the letter in 51 out of the Smithsonian Institute, said hogwash. Now, there's just no connection. We've never used it. It's a worthless book, and that's from an archaeological standpoint. And so that data was on the table, but that did not stop the Mormons from sharing this letter to give credibility, false credibility, to the Book of Mormon and archaeology. There is no relationship, connection between the New World archaeology, between the New World, and the Book of Mormon. This just doesn't exist. And you see another quote here from a fellow that's just an archaeologist from the New World, an expert in New World archaeology, and he just makes this, gives you his opinion based on what he knows. No one, not one professionally trained archaeologist who is not a Mormon, who sees any scientific justification for believing the foregoing is true, that is, the Book of Mormon as an accurate historical account of New World peoples. It just doesn't exist. Did he mention it in here? I think he did. Kinderhook plates. 1, 2, 3. Fourth line, so you're not lost. Fourth line on B. The view of the scientific community, and then B. Martin starts out, Mormon archaeologist. He refers to the Kinderhook plates. It's an interesting story in this, and let me just give you a thumbnail. There was some people that took some plates, put characters on them, dirtied them up, in essence, and buried them. And they later would go and look for them. And they made, you know, find these plates, and witnesses are going in and find them. So they pull them out. This was in Kinderhook, Illinois, is where he buried these things. Well, they give them to, send some of them to Smith. And Smith interprets them, says they mean this, and it was all a fraud. The Kinderhook plates were, and there were men that admitted to doing this, were made by men just to prove that Smith was a charlatan. And there's actually been subsequent analysis made of the material, how the hieroglyphics were formed, or the characters were formed on it. And so, you know, I think it was like in the 60s, went into chemical analysis, et cetera, and decided that, you know, they could validate what these men said that they made these things. So, you know, they took it upon themselves to show he was a charlatan and succeeded. When you look at the Book of Mormon, I gave you a list of things that doesn't happen, I guess is a way to describe that. You don't find any connection at all in the Book of Mormon with actual archaeological records. It just doesn't exist, period. And you see a list of those there. Think about the Bible for a moment. What do you know about the Bible in terms of archaeology? I don't need a scientific response. Just what about cities? You find them in the Bible list cities. Do people find it? Have they been found? Yes. People list names of people.
Not the Hittites.
Have they been found?
Yes.
And so, you know, as time goes on, more and more, as archaeologists have opportunity to excavate sites, they find these connections back to the Bible. And what's happened over the years, the skeptics have said, well, the Bible's wrong because there's no such place as this. And with time, these places are uncovered, and, well, there goes that one. I have to come up with another skeptical reason. And those have been eliminated one by one over time.
Even Luke's account, you know, and mentioning peoples and governors and things like that, they have just recently found.
Some of that has been recent. That's
right. He really did reign at that time.
Anything about that before we go on to the Book of Mormon against itself?
I find it interesting that another huge difference between God and the nature of God, which I think is another overall purpose of the Bible, God shows himself, and he never changes. The nature of God does not change, except when Christ took on flesh and come. But overall, God's nature didn't. The way he speaks to man also, it was in an understandable way that the time that God was speaking to the people, they didn't need another party to go in. Like, he didn't give Moses something that somebody else had to come in and to translate or to be another seer and that kind of thing to let them know. I'm not talking about language, you know, to another language. I'm talking about in order to understand and interpret.
Well, it was written to the people at the time.
Yeah.
To us, it's history. To them, it was the people at the time. The Bible is not a history book. The Bible has historical events in it, but the Bible is not written as a history book any more than the Gospels are written as a biography. And so they were written, what does Ephesians 3, 4, and 5 say?
That when you read, you can understand.
You can understand. That's what we did. Okay. Book of Mormon verses itself, it claims to have been translated by the power of God. It is not simply an inspired book in and of itself. The actual literal words were described as being provided by God through Joseph Smith. And I gave you, I'm not going to go through these, I hope you did. You go through and you find just time after time where they, between the original 1830 to 1881, there are changes. And these are not typos. Okay? These are not typographical problems. These are content problems. And I think I mentioned 4,000 changes in it over time. And that is inconsistent with, obviously, the idea that God was involved in it. One of the things I will draw your attention to on the first 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of these comparisons, you'll note that, remember that the Mormons started out one God, who is Spirit, and that transitioned over time to making a differentiation. And you see that showing up in the way the book has changed in 150 years, in some of these quotes that I give you. Okay? So again, I don't want to belabor all those unless there's some questions about it. Joseph Smith, let me comment about a couple comments about the table. This is Joseph Smith and the Book of Mormon. He did the Book of Mormon, which he did the Doctrines and Covenants, but he also, just within the Book of Mormon, or in his writing, he would describe differences. There's an evolution. If you look at Joseph Smith, there's some evolution, and then if you look at Joseph Smith, there's some changeability. Okay? You start off in the book, 2000 BC, Book of Mormon, and you can go back and look at these, by the way. Book of Mormon, not Book of Abraham. Book of Abraham is within the Pearl of Great Price. And what I want to mention to you is you can go and get downloadable or searchable documents on Book of Mormon, Doctrines and Covenants, Pearl of Great Price. Of course, your other standard work you've got already, which is the Bible. So all their standard works are available on their site in PDF form, ebook form, EPUB form, HTML form. You can search at your heart's content. Book of Abraham, Book of Moses, both out of the Pearl of Great Price. So you can look at these up and see, is this true that this is the way the Book of Mormon or the Pearl, in this case, Pearl of Great Price changed. One book has plurality God. One book has monotheism. And you go to the Book of Mormon, monotheism is where you've got God the Father, takes on a different state, which is God the Son, takes on a different state, which is God the Holy Spirit, takes on a different state, back to God the Father. It's different modes that one God shows up as. You get in early DNC, he was in the monotheism. We've looked at that. And then he gave lectures 4 years later, and now he was talking about bi-theism. He gives DNC, later part of DNC, possibly plurality of God. It was possible there's more than one God. And then by the time you get to 131 in DNC, there are plurality of gods. King Follett Discourse, by the way, is a funeral service. And I just give you a couple comments out of that. This is program that Hinckley, which is one of the presidents of the Mormon Church, a recent president, had an interview with Time, and they asked him a question. So just another related question that comes up is the statements in the King Follett Discourse by the Prophet, that is Joseph Smith, gave this discourse, the funeral service. And he goes on to ask, God the Father was once man as we were. This is something that the Christian writers are always addressing. Is this the teaching of the church today, that God the Father was once a man like we are? Now, he's asking this question of a president, top dog, the top dog of the Mormon Church, a prophet by their description. Here is his answer. I don't know that we teach it. I don't know that we emphasize it. I haven't heard it discussed in a long time in public discourse. I don't know. I don't know all the circumstances in which this statement was made. I understand the philosophical background behind it, but I don't know a lot about it, and I don't know that others know a lot about it. I have the King Follett address, and it's exactly what he said in it. Joseph Smith said he was once a man like us, yea, that God himself, the Father of us all, dwell on earth, the same as Jesus Christ himself did. And I will show it from the Bible. And they do teach it. I mean, there's just no two ways about it. They teach it. So he just didn't want to admit what he was teaching, I guess. Okay, so that is Joseph Smith.
Correct.
Yes.
Yeah, on page 66, I think I've seen this this is what I notice anytime you talk to Mormons. Page 66, I think it says, every intelligent person under the heavens that does not, when informed, acknowledge that Joseph Smith is a prophet of God is in darkness and is opposed to us and to Jesus and his kingdom on the earth. I always find that very interesting that the Mormons like to lift up just one man, and they lift him up even above God and Jesus Christ, who is Son. And I say, you notice, you never see that in the Bible. Every prophet in the Bible had to decrease. I mean, John the Baptist himself had to recognize that. He must increase and I must decrease. No one is ever exalted or put in any par with Jesus Christ, the Son of God,
right,
who is died, buried, and resurrected again. Every other man is dead, flat dead, period. And Joseph Smith, the Mormon, seems to make a very hard case about exalting a human being, another human being, which is the most strange, like you described it. That's a typical characteristic of a cult.
Yeah.
And they don't get that.
That's a good observation. And look, they don't, they don't make any bones about it. We've looked at some other traits, some other teachings, our quotes, that suggest the same thing. And, they're in essence, Brigham Young, Joseph Smith, both presented themselves as they are between you and salvation. And if you don't accept them, you're banned. All right.
But even today, isn't it true that they now, as you started out, they minimize some of the teachings of Joseph Smith? So the very person that this talks about, the practice today, is they don't want to talk about his early prophecies and things. To the extent that they've changed.
They don't want to talk about controversial stuff associated with Joseph Smith. It's like they don't want to talk about the Adam God doctrine or blood atonement doctrine of Brigham Young. And they'll run away from it. And it's not being taught today. And when it comes to Joseph Smith, 9 times out of 10, what they'll probably try to describe to you, you just don't understand. You need to read, particularly on the Book of Mormon, you need to pray about it and you'll understand. Okay? You understand that book. Look, I want to do something before the class is up. We only got 5 minutes. And because you have everything I was going to talk about in terms of the next page or so, and they're just examples to point out this discrepancy between what Joseph Smith said, maybe a table, and what the Book of Mormon said. And so you get this conflict. Is there one God or many? You get another conflict. Is God spirit or flesh? You get another conflict. Is God always an exalted man? And so you just this stuff is just runs out your ears when you go looking for it. And then you get I gave you some other examples within the Book of Mormon or DNC, and these are things that, again, Joseph Smith is involved in, and in most cases, if not all, I think they were all written by Joseph Smith. So they're all inconsistent within themselves. Remember what we talked about before is what happens when, or why do you get these inconsistencies? It's because it's a man doing it. Pure and simple. And, it's obvious to us, not as obvious to them. I listed for you a list of doctrines that are not in the Book of Mormon. So, here's my sharing with you. I want to spend. Yeah, we'll see. We had a case. Let me just say, I've been saying these things about the Mormons, and we had an opportunity. Justin had gotten an opportunity to study with a couple of Mormon guys, jumped. They were out bike riding. He was out running. He invited them to the house. He had a session with them. He had two guys, as always. And he, at the end of the day, they agreed to come back. And they agreed that Joseph Smith could be shown to be, if it could be shown that Joseph Smith's prophecies, any of them, did not come true, then as a result of that, they would accept the fact, at least they consider the fact, that he was not a prophet. So, we got another meeting set, met last night, him, me, Steve, and Jerome, Justin's cousin. And it was an interesting meeting. I do want to share with you kind of what went on in that meeting as a learning exercise. And I was hoping I'd do it today, but it's probably going to be better done as a pickup before we get into JW's Wednesday. So I'm fighting you back and trying to encourage you to come back. We'll talk about that a little bit. When we talk about Mormonism, teaching a Mormon. I hope you, I mean, this is really for your benefit, but we can use this as an outline. I want to spend about 10 minutes to walk through it. And just give you some feedback on the experience we've had. And, you know, where does that, validate what we've been saying? Does it give you some insight, give us, all of us, some insight on how you might conduct yourself if you ever had this opportunity? You know, if I had it do over again, I would tactically change what we did, but would not, as they say, strategically take a different approach. It would still go after the prophet Joseph Smith, but I think there's some things you might be able to do to kind of set the scene to try to avoid having a back door. The Mormons have a back door, and I'll call it a back door. I'll share that with you. So come back Wednesday.